is a super freaking awesome woman. I love her so much, and I have the oh-so-great privilege of calling her my sponsor and friend, because she's great. And here's Becca.
Thank you, my oh-so-awesome sponsee. So as I was preparing this today, I saw something online that said AA speaker meetings are like emotional TED Talks. So, hi, my name's Becca. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. And welcome to my TED Talk. My sobriety date is June 26, 2021. I have an amazing sponsor, and my sponsor has a sponsor. And if you don't have a sponsor, you should definitely get a sponsor, because that's part of our program and definitely a key. AA is a spiritual program, and my spiritual journey is very much aligned with my sobriety journey. So I hope that you will bear with me as I kind of merge the two. We normally start out with background, so I will tell you a little bit about where I came from. I was born and raised in Albany, Georgia. Oh my God. Not normally that many people. So Albany is a small town in southwest Georgia. I jokingly tell people that I am the somewhat liberal lesbian daughter of a conservative Republican family in southwest Georgia. So I didn't really fit in. I didn't feel like I fit in, for sure, growing up. My family, I was very, very privileged. In my family, I was born to a family that had money. And so I didn't have immediate needs that needed taken care of. I was always fed. I was always clothed. I always had shelter. I always had all those things, right? And to most people, from the outside looking in, we were a very normal kind of Norman Rockwell kind of family, right? But inside our walls of our home were a little bit different. My parents did the best they could. They passed down a lot of really wonderful life lessons. My father taught me how to be a hard worker, and my mother showed a lot of compassion to people outside of our home, and so I kind of learned those things from them. They definitely passed down softer punches than what they were given, but they definitely passed down punches, literally and figuratively, right? So there was a history of emotional, mental, and physical abuse in my house growing up. I realized that, I don't know, it took like maybe 30 years for me to really realize that we don't live in a world where seven-year-olds deserve to get punched. I just thought that was normal, right? If I had met people in an AA room when I was seven, it would have been normal. But it's not really normal for that kind of stuff to be going on. So my parents weren't necessarily alcoholics, but they definitely had problem drinking habits that would surface. My parents really loved life, which means that they loved good food and they loved good booze. My father, when I was 2 years old, he was a businessman, he was a financial planner, and he opened up a liquor store when I was two. So a lot of alcoholics will say things like, I grew up in a liquor store. No, y'all, I literally grew up in a liquor store. It was a real magical place for a kid, right? It was back in the 80s. They had all these little, like, price tags that were so fun to slide and move in different spots. I have no idea why the manager was always pissed off that my brother and I were there. We just changed all the prices on all the booze. The smell of boxes and bottles in a walk-in cooler was pretty normal during the summer on hot days, right? So that's kind of where I grew up. There was a full bar in my house in between the kitchen and the living room, and my dad really loved the European lifestyle, which meant that as kids, we were allowed to drink. Holidays, we would have wine, and then by 8 years old, I was playing bartender and making my mom's bourbon and Cokes. Right, and sipping them on the way to deliver them to her as the waitress. And moving on up into margaritas by the time I was like 11, right? So that's kind of where I came from and how all of that started. We were definitely a church-going family. I was raised Lutheran, so if you don't know what that is, I call that Catholic light. So it's a little more on the conservative side of things. But we would go to church every Sunday, every Sunday school, every church function, every potluck, like we were there. And it kind of became my safe space. That was the place where people actually didn't judge me. And that was the place where people didn't hit me or tell me that I was wrong. And then, because I didn't really have a great example of what love looked like, I started searching for love in other places, right? So I saw it within people, within the congregation. And then I really started learning Jesus' teachings. And then that is when I was like, oh, that's what love is supposed to look like. Well, I don't know that anybody can really live up to that on a daily basis. But at that point, I knew that what I was dealing with at home, even though these people told me they loved me, didn't really reflect what love should be in the world. I can remember when I was probably about 8 years old, and I think it was a birthday party, and one of the adults was asking all the kids, what do you want to be when you grow up? And all my friends had an answer. I want to be a policeman. I want to be a fireman. And I did not have an answer. And I was like, oh, I don't know what I want to do. And so I went to bed, and I woke up a few days later. I had some dream, and I ran downstairs, and I was like, Mom, I got it. I know what I want to do. And she said, what? I said, I want to be a nun. And she looked horrified because she was raised Catholic, and her impression of nuns were the ladies that would smack your hands with a ruler when something went wrong in school, right? And so she looked at me, her only daughter, and was like, honey, you can't be a nun. We're Lutheran. We're not Catholic. And I was like, oh, man. Like, I was so deflated, I had no idea. Now, in retrospect, my favorite movie at the time was The Sound of Music. And being that I was gay and didn't know it, I definitely had a crush on Julie Andrews as a child. But if you've ever seen that movie, Maria does not make a very good nun, and I don't think I would have either. So I'm kind of glad that that route did not turn out the way that I wanted it to when I was young. But I never did feel like I fit in. And in second grade, I was diagnosed with some learning disabilities, so school became kind of difficult for me. I had dyslexia, ADD, and a processing disorder. Reading was real tough, right? Those kind of things. And around 10, I started displaying some signs of mental illness. So depression runs in the women of my family, and I was clearly just geared up to fit right into that category with everybody else in my family. At 10, I started some pretty bad habits, some self-sabotaging habits, some bad habits, right? And I started picking up cigarettes at 10, right? So I started picking up cigarettes at 10. At 11, I would say what I would consider to be sexual misconduct started taking place. I knew that it was wrong. I did not want to be doing it, but I was in a situation where I didn't know how to say no to the person it was happening with, and I was too afraid to come forward to my family for any kind of help, so I just kind of shoved it all down, shut it in, and shut it out. That really kicked the depression off into a whole other level with all the guilt and shame around that. At 12, I started drinking regularly. I had two older brothers that would come home from college, and when they would come home, I would go to the bar, and I would grab liquor bottles, because my parents would just assume that the boys came home and partied way too hard, and then they would just replace the bottles. And so that started that. They'd come home every couple months. I'd be grabbing bottles left and right. I'd stash them. 12 years old, I'm stashing bottles underneath my bed. And as soon as I would empty them, I would take them out and either throw them away, or I would stash them somewhere in my closet until I could take them somewhere and throw them away. And I was taking vodka in my thermos and things like that at 12. At 13, I had a beautiful body of a full-grown woman, which was lovely to me, but unfortunately also lovely to pedophiles, so that resulted in my first sexual assault at 13. Again, never telling my parents anything that was happening or going on. And at 14, I decided that I was really done and had absolutely no light and no hope, and I tried to commit suicide. I took a whole bottle of pills. Luckily, it made me very sick, and so I just threw them up and told my parents I had eaten something bad at school, and they assumed I either had a stomach bug or something. They never knew. But also at 14, again, church was that safe space for me, right? And so I really dug in to the people at church, and I signed up for every service worker thing I could sign up for that would give me more time at church. So I became an acolyte, just the person that lights all the candles. Then I became a member of the choir, because there were choir rehearsals on Wednesdays. Then I became a lay reader, which is the person that gets behind the pulpit and like reads scripture and things like that. And just kept signing up for more and more stuff so that I could really participate in that. I took on some leadership positions within the youth group. And then one of my friends who went to a totally different church was like, you should come to our youth group. And I was like, yes, I should. And so then I started going to hers, which was really great when we all got to be driving age, because then we could just get stoned on the way home. And it was, you know, that was it. We'd go to youth group and then we'd get high on the way home. It was great. It's exactly what you want to do at church, right? So all of that, though, to say this, when I joined that other youth group, her mother was the one that was leading it, and she was getting a master's degree, and so she would bring some psychology stuff into the youth group that she thought young people should hear, and one of those things was alcoholism education. And I can remember her handing us a checklist of, like, these are potential behavior problems for people who are alcoholics. And I went down that list and was like, oh, shit. And at 14, I figured out that I had a problem. And so I mustered up the courage to go to my parents and say, hey, I think I'm an alcoholic. And they laughed because, you know, who would believe a 14-year-old? My mom said, honey, you can't be an alcoholic. You're not stashing bottles anywhere. So I took her to my bedroom and gave her the bottles. She was like, oh. And then I told my dad, hey, I think I'm an alcoholic. And he said, well, honey, you can't be an alcoholic. You're not that skinny. And I was like, oh, well, okay. And he said, well, thank God, at least you're not pregnant. I was like, oh, okay. And but then they decided, you know what, we better get the kid some help. And so they did do that for me. They took me to a psychiatrist. The psychiatrist said, you should really put her in rehab. And so at 15, I went into rehab. I don't know, I was there for several weeks. It was actually really good. I learned a lot while I was there. But then when I got out of rehab, you can't just go to rehab and that be it. Like, you have to follow up with meetings in order for sobriety to be successful. So I went to my parents and said, hey, I need to go to some AA meetings. And they didn't really want me to go, but I convinced them because I had a really big, tall friend who would go with me, and he would drive me. And so we went to my first AA meeting outside of rehab, and we met this other kid who was 17. His name was Rufus. And Rufus had been an NA and had been an AA, and he said, well, you know what, if you guys want to, we can just do a meeting with the three of us. What could possibly go wrong? Three teenagers doing their own sobriety meeting. So Roger had this shack in his backyard where we would go and party, and so we used the party shack as an NA meeting site. We would do the meeting, and then, you know, we would smoke cigarettes and we would smoke weed. That continued for probably a solid month, maybe a month and a half, until one day after an NA meeting, Rufus pulled out some crack and said, hey, you guys want to try some crack? And we were like, yeah, sure, why not? And that ended any hope of sobriety and opened up a whole new door to a whole bunch of other drugs and party and lifestyle for me at the age of 15. So all of that happens. After that, it really escalated. I started blackout drinking really young. I remember I was 15 once when I went to a hotel room with a friend and one of his friends, and we got hammered, and they waited until I passed out, and I experienced being raped. Then at 16, I was arrested for the first time for underage drinking. I was actually very mad at that occasion. Missy's laughing because she knows this story. So I'd stolen a key to my dad's office, and since Albany, Georgia is a very small town, and on Friday nights when there was nobody doing anything, we would go to my dad's office and we would use that as a party pad and we would drink. And so me and my friend Patty go, and we're at dad's office. We drink like half a bottle of bourbon, and we're getting ready to leave. I'd parked the car around back, but in the back of the building there was this other lady that lived in a trailer way back here, and she had called the cops because there was a car there every Friday night. And so I'm rolling up to the car with Patty, and the cop's knocking on the door, and he yells at us, and he screams at us, you wait right there! I tried to hide the bottle under the car tire. That did not work. But I was so good at holding my liquor at 16 that we had somehow managed to convince this cop that Patty was the one drinking and that I had just had a few sips of whatever she was drinking. And he put her in the back of the cop car and told me to drive my car to follow him to the police station. So we did that. And the thing that really pissed me off was that the lady that called the cops I had just bought drugs from the week before, she had a wooden leg, and we called her Peg Leg Donna. And so I was so mad that Peg Leg Donna had called the cops on me for drinking that I did not learn a lesson from that. But mama ain't raised no snitch and no bitch, so I did not snitch on Donna. She lived to deal another day. So around 16 also, mom had enough of dad. Dad's violence got a little worse as we got older, and she decided she didn't want to be there anymore, so she packed her bags and she left. She did come back after a while, but at that point the damage had been done. I cannot tell you during that time period when the first time I had a blackout drunk was, but I can tell you the first time that it really scared me. I was about 17 years old, and I woke up like we do during blackouts and go, where am I? And then looked at my ceiling, realized I was in my room, and was like, whew. Then I remembered that I drove the night before, and I had no idea how I'd gotten home. And I kind of assumed that my friend Jerry must have driven me home. But I'd had my mom's car, and if I didn't have that back before she woke up to go to work, I would be in a lot of trouble. So I, in my pajamas, I ran outside, and the car was there. And I was like, uh-oh. And I called Jerry, and I'm like, hey, dude, thanks for driving me home last night. And he's like, what are you talking about? You drove me home. You drove so-and-so home. Zero recollection of any of it, right? So I was 17 when that happened. Also, around 17, I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. I knew I needed to get out of my house, and so that kind of meant, you know, college. And then my dad mentioned, well, it can be college, it can be military, or it can be seminary, your choice, but you're going to get out. And I agreed with that wholeheartedly. I knew it wasn't going to be military because I had a smart mouth, and the first time somebody mouthed off of me, I was going to cuss them out, and that would not have been a good military career. So it was, you know, either seminary or college. And I really did consider seminary, but I thought college would offer more opportunities and also more parties. So college was the route that I chose. But at that point in time, at 17, I didn't really know if I wanted to get a degree and go into something like business or if I wanted to be a criminal mastermind, because I was smart and I wanted to learn a lot of blue-collar crimes. So I started to learn a lot of things that would help me in any direction I wanted to go in life. I may or may not have learned a few things about the distribution of certain substances on the streets. I may or may not have learned a few things about breaking and entering, which can occasionally come in handy when you lock your keys in your house. But I learned how to do a lot of things I shouldn't, and a lot of things that were good and helpful. So nobody thought that I would graduate high school, but I did, even though I skipped like 30 days in the semester. I was smart enough to figure out exactly what grades I had to have in order to pass a class, and I would make exactly those grades and no more, and passed my classes and graduated high school. Got into Georgia Southern, which is a great party school, and yes, it is. So had fun at Georgia Southern for about a year. I actually left Southern. I went in, of course, at 18 and then left at 19, not because of partying, but because I'd had my first toxic relationship. And after the breakup and fallout of that relationship, I went into a depressive spell for about 30 or 45 days. I didn't actually see sunlight. I didn't leave my dorm room and things like that. So the mental health aspect hit me pretty hard. And so I got a medical withdrawal from college and then left that. My dad was like, well, you need to come home. And I told him exactly where he could stick that idea. And ended up getting a job at a gas station. I had just enough money to put down a down payment and to move in with some people. So I moved into a tiny little duplex with three other people and three cats. I had not a pot to piss in. I slept on the floor. There was a time there where I didn't even have clean clothes, and so I was using like dirty towels as a blanket and things like that. Didn't know where my next meals were coming from, but I did not care. I was not going home. At that point, somehow I always had drugs and alcohol. I don't know, I'd be starving, but somehow I always managed to have drugs and alcohol, right? Either I would sell enough of something to have enough for my party supplies or whatever the case was. I always seemed to have enough. During my 20s, there would be a slew of drugs. There was alcohol, weed, LSD, mushrooms, pills, Oxycontin hit the streets, so I had a real big problem with that for a while. Cocaine, meth, and ecstasy were all part of my story at that point. And when I was 23, I became what I would call a drug alchemist, where I could tell you what drug cocktails you could mix to get what effect. And if you didn't want that effect, I could tell you what other drugs to mix to change it, right? And so I had my knowledge down. And that continued until about 26 years old when I had what I call my Jenny moments. Anybody seen Forrest Gump? Yeah. Right? There's that scene where like Jenny gets way too doped up and she's like standing on the edge of the balcony. My scene didn't happen in a balcony. It happened in a hotel bathroom. And I was looking in a mirror. I had blood running down my nose. My eyes were sunken in. I noticed for the first time how I looked like death. Like, to me, I looked like death. My face was like a skeleton. It turns out underneath all this fluff and stuff, I actually have really high cheekbones. And they were just protruding right through, and I looked like a skeleton. My skin, my face was pale, my eyes were sunken, dark circles around my eyes. And I realized that entire lifestyle was going to kill me, and it was going to kill me pretty quick if I didn't stop it. So I turned my back on everyone and everything that I knew. tried to get clean, relapsed a few times, and then I met somebody that was a good friend of mine for a long time, and I fell in love with her. And she was not going to put up with the really hard drugs. She would do some drugs. She would definitely drink with me. But she was not going to put up with that kind of lifestyle. And so it became a lot easier to transition into softer drugs at that point and kind of get away from some of the hard stuff. So I did that. Ended up falling in love with her. Ended up marrying her. We were together for 15 years. We partied a lot during that 15 years. We lived in Savannah, which was a great place to spend your 20s. Because you can drink publicly in Savannah, just walk down the street with your drinks. And that was definitely an intention in moving there. I had all that, and we stayed together for a really long time. Drank a lot, partied a lot, and then I always managed to be functional, right? I don't know how, but I did manage to be functional. I always held a job. In fact, I had a really good job here in Atlanta at one point. I was a training manager at a major hospital here in Atlanta during the COVID-19 pandemic. And so I trained hand-in-hand with infection preventionists in the COVID rooms, on the COVID floors, trained all the teams on how to disinfect surfaces from COVID-19, how to clean patient rooms and all that kind of stuff at the fifth busiest hospital in the United States. All the death and the stress and the things that I saw there were absolute gravy compared to the real problem during COVID, which is that the bars closed. So, the bars closing ended up being a really big problem because I was binge drinking on the weekends, and we would have Wednesday night date nights, which we would go out for wings and drinks, and we no longer had those options. And it turns out there was a liquor store a quarter mile away from my house. And so then 3 nights a week became 4 nights a week, 4 nights became 5 nights, stressful days, which was every day in a hospital during COVID, became regular drinks, right, every single night. Then, a few months later, my marriage exploded to non-alcohol or drug-related events. That is a whole different TED Talk worthy of a Maury Povich show, but that we'll cover that in another day. So then, once that explosion happened, I filed for divorce, and that time period between filing for divorce and getting her out of my house was an absolute nightmare. Even days that I didn't want to drink, I'd come home and she'd be hammered, and at that point I would have to drink because I was not dealing with that crap sober. Then she left the house, and a new problem emerged. The house was quiet, and there was nobody there to tell me, no, don't open that bottle of wine at 9 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday, right? And then I just took my liberty and took my freedom and drank whenever I wanted to. I do what I want. Then that's exactly the kind of attitude I had. I do what I want. Now that I'm by myself in my house, who's going to tell me nothing? Right? And so that's exactly what happened and what I did. And I started drinking every single night. First it was one bottle of wine, then it was two bottles of wine, then it was a 1.5 liter bottle of wine, then it was two 1.5 bottles. I was drinking 3 liters of wine a night, 6 nights a week, and then adding on bottles of bourbon and Jaeger here and there throughout the week and on the weekends. And it got really bad. It got really bad. During that time period, there was an accident where I blacked out behind the wheel on 285. And I woke up as my hubcaps were scraping the concrete wall around the side, and I jerked my car back into the lanes. That was a miracle in itself. If I had hit that wall at any other angle, I probably wouldn't be standing here. And there was no traffic oncoming in the first two lanes of 285 that night. So I absolutely thank my higher power for that one, because there's no way I would have survived that. I nearly burned my house down twice. Once because I blacked out and passed out and had lit candles. And you believe in symbolism. I woke up when a pillar candle had gotten this big right on top of a Bible next to my bed. And was like, oh, wow. One time I did catch my porch on fire. And I took no responsibility for it at first in true alcoholic fashion. I woke up and opened my eyes and was like, man, my neighbors must be burning leaves or something, right? I get ready. I'm getting ready to go to church, and I step out on my back porch to smoke a cigarette, and the whole corner of my back porch is still smoldering because I had a pile of cigarettes there, and I was so drunk the night before, I just threw one on top, didn't put it out correctly, and the whole thing caught on fire while I was sleeping. And so, of course, after I took buckets of water and got all of that done and smoldering, the first thing I did was look at my dog and be like, how could you let me sleep through that? What kind of dog are you? You didn't bark. You just snoring next to me all night long. Poor Murphy. Poor Murphy has gotten so much of my BS over the years. He still catches my BS. I feel so bad for him. He's such a good boy. And so, you know, all of those things happened. I really, during my whole journey between the drugs and the alcohol, I screwed over a lot of people. Way back in the day in my 20s, it was really bad financially. It's really a miracle I didn't go to jail for check fraud, because we were writing checks left and right back then. And you could also bounce bank accounts, so I would get one bank account, 500 negative, go open up another one, dump it 500 negative, open up another one until there were no more banks to open up, and used all of that money on drugs and alcohol. I stole money from people. I destroyed relationships. It was not pretty. It wasn't good. And I became, at this point in time, somebody really dishonest, right? I was still drunk every morning. And so I would get up, and the first thing I would do on Monday mornings, I was teaching orientation, and I'd have to tell them, you can't walk into work with any alcohol or marijuana in your system, because if you get drug tested, you're going to be fired immediately, knowing damn good and well that I had all of that in my system when I was talking to them. I became somebody I didn't really recognize anymore. I got to the point where I would get the jitters and start getting nauseous about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I would have to hit the liquor store at 4 p.m., otherwise I would really start getting sick. And I started thinking, maybe I should just put a flask in my car. And I thought, maybe this is a problem, is really what this is. I had all those things going. I really hurt somebody that I liked a lot. During this period of time, I also found a spiritual home. A friend of mine and I were looking for a spiritual center. I was dying for a connection to a higher power at that point, because I was so close to what I believed to be God when I was young. And so we walked into a spiritual center not far from here, Trinity Center for Spiritual Living, and it seemed like the reverend there, it was like God was speaking through that reverend to me. And I was like, oh, man, this is it. This is my home. And so I'd been there 3 weeks when I really betrayed somebody that I liked and felt like I'd ripped my soul. And I looked at myself in the mirror and I didn't recognize who I was physically anymore. My face was all puffy and splotchy, and I looked awful even when I tried to dress nicely. I didn't recognize my behaviors anymore. I wasn't who I thought I was anymore. I didn't recognize my finances anymore. I was not recognizing who I was as an employee anymore. Like, there was literally, I sat at my kitchen table and looked around, and every single surface on my kitchen counter was covered with an empty bottle. And I was like, oh my God, I'm not managing anything. Like, I was used to having to juggle things, but maybe work was bad, but home was good, or maybe home was good, but work was bad. And I was not managing anything. And I thought, my life is completely unmanageable. This is crazy. And then I heard this little voice, which I believe to be my higher power, say, you need a 12-step program. And I went, what? AA? No, we're not there yet, right? Like, I know we're on the road there, but we're not there yet, right? Oh, I don't know. Let me look at the steps. Step one, admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. And I was like, shit. I just literally used those words to describe my life, and there they were right in front of me, in front of step one. And I was like, oh my God, yeah, I gotta do this. This is a problem. And so I did. That was on a Thursday night. I had that revelation. Friday night, of course, I went out to my favorite cider house and got hammered one last time. And then Saturday evening, I went to my first AA meeting, and it was awful. Awful. It was a meeting on the south side. Those people were not my people. They did not relate to me. They stared at me when I walked in the room. As I walked across, no one said a single word to me. I had to go up to the speaker afterwards and be like, hey, I heard you have brochures. What do you recommend? And they were just like, they're over there. I mean, like, it was bad. But I was like, okay, you know what? If I really want to do this, these were just not my people. I just need to go find other meetings. And so I looked up meetings here on Sunday, and there was one right here at NABA at 9 a.m. on Sunday morning, right before I would go to the spiritual center. And I was like, all right, I'm going to give that a shot. And I came in, and it was an awesome meeting. And I met wonderful people who gave me their number, one of whom is now my sponsor. And they told me about another meeting at the Biscayne Room that happened at 6 p.m. during the weeks. And I was like, you know what? This is a good idea. I'm going to start replacing my liquor store runs with a meeting every single day. And I started doing the things that were suggested to me. I listened and did the things that were suggested to me. I did, I think, like 95 meetings in 90 days. I listened in meetings, and I heard the words that I needed to hear as if God was speaking directly to me. I would listen to speaker tapes and things like that on the way to work and on the way back so that I always had that connection with AA and stayed kind of tapped into the things that AA would do. And then I started to work the steps. And at first I did it by myself because I'm stubborn and hard-headed and I did not want to get a sponsor. I was like, I can tell somebody what I'm doing? No. I'm not going to do that. One and two, I'd already pretty much had by the time I came into the rooms, right? I knew that I was powerless over alcohol. I did believe that there was a higher power that could help me with that. And so I worked really hard on those. I went online. I found videos from psychologists who were also in recovery to figure out what kind of practices and journal things I could do. And I journaled the crap out of step one and two by myself. And then I got to step three, which is to surrender, and I got stuck. It's like, how do you turn your will over to God? I don't know how to do that. It seems like I should know how to do that, but I don't know how to do that. And that's when I decided to get a sponsor. And so I got my amazing sponsor, and she looked at the work I'd done, and she went, wow, because I'm anal retentive and a perfectionist, like a good alcoholic, so I had to do my work. And so she helped me through it. She helped me through the step three, and I had a spiritual awakening very early on within the first, I'd say like 30, 40 days. I was sitting in meditation at the spiritual center, and I had set some boundaries in place with people who were not in my life for my best and highest good, and I cut them out. That was the first time in my life I'd ever done that. And I had committed myself to AA and was doing the work, and I was sitting in this meditation, and I just felt this energy fly through my body. I felt peace like I had never felt before, and it was almost as if like I had been sitting in a slingshot for 20 years and that somebody had released that slingshot, and I felt free inside of my soul for the first time in my life. And I was like, holy crap, this has got to be what a spiritual awakening is. But I continued through AA, and one of the things that I think we don't talk about enough, and it's probably because we don't want to scare anybody, but, you know, as you get sober, your emotions start coming up, and when you have never allowed yourself to feel things from the age of a child, you don't even know what feelings are, and you don't know how to process any of that stuff. And so when all of that would come up, and then I would start thinking about my past and all of the trauma that I dealt with in my past, and had all these huge emotions that were really painful, it became really scary, and I didn't know if I could do it. I was like, I don't think I can live sober. I can't do this. How do you do this? How do you handle your life and your past sober? I could not do it. And so I began to think, well, you know what, it's okay. It's okay. You know, maybe we'll just plan an exit. And if we need to commit suicide, we will commit suicide if that's the way that we have to go. And so I started planning. And 3 to 4 months into sobriety, I planned my entire suicide. And once I had planned it, I felt this whole relief come over me. And I was like, whew. And then I went, oh, no. Because that's when it gets dangerous, right? If you don't know that, when you make a plan and you feel peace about it, that's when it's dangerous, and that's when you need to get help. And if you're somebody that has dual diagnoses, please make sure that you get mental health support as you go through this journey. You 100% can get sober. You can do it, and we can help because you are not alone in this. But you have got to have safety systems in place, okay? And so I had a therapist. I called her. We adjusted medication. We increased our meetings. We put a safety system in place and all of those things. And I continued with the steps. And I continued with my fourth step. I know people say it's really scary. It wasn't that scary to me. It was really more surprising than anything. I had no idea that I was that angry because I've dealt with depression my whole life. And underneath that depression was apparently a hell of a lot of anger and a hell of a lot of resentment. So it was good to see all of that and to get relief from all of that with step five, to be able to tell somebody about it. Step six and seven, learning to surrender and pray and connect to that higher power again, was really important in that. And then eight was pretty easy, making the list to make amends. I'm good at lists. I can make lists all day long. Making the amends part has definitely been a journey, right? It's kind of an ongoing journey. And I'm making some living amends, particularly to my ex-wife, that I will make and pray for her for the rest of my life, or hers, whatever comes first. So that has been an ongoing process. 10 and 11, I was already doing. My awesome sponsor looked at me and was like, you need to do gratitude lists every day. You need to do a daily reflection and see where you are selfish and self-centered and dishonest and all these things every single day. And so I'd already been doing them. That was pretty easy to keep doing that. And then carrying on the message, not only have I sponsored people, but I am the lead admin for a large NAAA LGBTQ Facebook group. And we support people all over the world. So people who are LGBTQ, come on. Most of them are new. They're just looking for gay-friendly meetings in their area. We don't have a big problem with that here in the Atlanta area, but that's not the case everywhere. We all know that it's supposed to be principles before personalities, but that is not always the case. And so there are areas that are a little more dangerous than others, and I am able to help connect those people with people in their area to help get them sober. And that has been the biggest blessing of service work that I have done. I took all of those suggestions and I did everything that I needed to do. I can remember being about 30 days in and looking at a friend and saying, hey, where are the single sober women at that like to date? Where are the lesbians? Where are they? And he said, how much time do you have? And I said, 30 days. He said, yeah, don't. And I was like, this, I did not want to listen, but I did. I did listen, and I'm really glad I did, because at the end of the first year, I wasn't the same person I was 30 days in. Anybody I would have matched with at that point in time would not have been a match for me a year later, and it wouldn't have been an honest relationship. I had to wait till I got through all of that stuff and go through all the steps and get rid of some of that stuff and heal some of that crap, right? How'd you get through that? The promises started coming true in my life. It was incredible. Once I got through that past year, I did date, and I dated someone wonderful, and it was the healthiest relationship I'd ever had in my life. She was kind. She was sober. She taught me a lot. It was a really wonderful relationship. The only reason we were not together now is just because when we really looked at our future, they didn't really align. We wanted different things, right? But I'm so grateful for that. I ended up getting a promotion. I left the hospital, went into airport security, where I was the training manager for the internal security of the airport, another easy job. But I did it, and I did it sober, and it was great. And then at the end of that, at some point I was like, you know what, this is not really what I want to do. What do I really want to do? And I thought, if I could wave a magic wand, what would I do? And the answer that came to me surprised me, and it was, you know what, I would open up my own business. I would leave my job, and I would go back to school full time and actually get a degree. And so I did it. I had that thought on a Saturday. On Sunday, there were emails in my inbox about getting student loans. I was like, you know what? Let's just see where this goes. I applied. I got student loans on a Sunday. On a Monday, I was approved. On a Tuesday, I called my advisor because I was already taking one class a semester anyway and said, hey, what would it take to go full time? I know classes start in a week. And he said, I got you. And he unlocked that bad boy in 4 days. I had the resources I needed to go back to school and to live my dreams. And I was like, holy crap, look at this happening. And so I did. I left my job. I am a Reiki practitioner and spiritual counselor, and so I opened up my own business with that. I pet sit on the sides in order to make money, and I went back to school. Not only did I go to Clayton State to work on a degree in psychology, but I had started taking classes at the Spiritual Center, and Reverend Tony looked at us one day and he said, you know what, just in case anybody's interested, these classes count for credit through the Emerson Theological Institute. So if you want to get a degree or you want to get a ministerial license, you can do that. And I had a flashback immediately to that little girl when I was 7 years old who wanted to be a nun and who wanted to live her life in service to God. And I just lost it. I realized in that moment of time that was a calling for me, and that is exactly what I had to do. And so I did. I took classes at Clayton State full-time. I took classes at a spiritual center full-time. I took 6 years of classes in 3 years. Remember, y'all, I'm dyslexic, ADD, and have a processing disorder, okay? So none of this was, like, super easy. It's been a really, really tough several years. I've only got 4 years sober, but it's been like a rocket ship. My journey has been a rocket ship since I have been sober. And so I got my ministerial degree last year. I finished that. This May, I graduated from Clayton State with my bachelor's in psychology. I am one course away from getting my master's degree in religious studies, and I'm already taking classes that are going to apply towards a doctorate degree sometime next year. So, thank you. I also noticed this year that my 10th and 11th step were kind of slipping. I was not doing my daily inventory the way I needed to, and so I built a tool to help myself do that that included a gratitude list, it included service work, like do something nice for people every day, and included a daily inventory, like what were you proud of, what are you happy about, where were you selfish, dishonest, all those things, and I ended up publishing it. And so it became a workbook. It's a daily spiritual workbook. Not only are people buying it on Amazon, which is really freaking cool, but I set up donations through my website so people can donate any amount of money, and when I get enough donations, I buy those books and then I bring them to addicts who cannot afford them. So I cannot tell you the depth of joy, of gratitude, of direction and purpose that my life has been fulfilled with because I started AA and because I started this journey. It has been an incredible spiritual journey and an incredible journey into sobriety. I'm a staff minister at the Trinity Center for Spiritual Living now, and that has been a really big joy. It hasn't been easy, right? Sobriety is never that easy. It's not like life was handed to me. On top of all of that, my parents also have dementia. They were diagnosed a couple years ago with dementia. My mother's flavor of dementia comes with a schizophrenia psychosis, so she's really not the same person that she used to be. But I have been sober through all of it. And I'm so grateful I have, because I actually really enjoy the relationship I have with my family right now. Like, hardcore, love it. I love my parents. And I didn't know that that was something that I could say. I didn't know that I could love as deeply as I love. I didn't know I could find as much joy as deeply as I find joy now in everything in life. AA has given me a version that I never could have imagined myself. I never dreamed I could do any of the things that I've been doing, but I've been doing them one step at a time, and it's been incredible. Sobriety is not a linear thing. It's not like we go from being wasted to being sober, right? It's like going up a mountain, and every time we take another step, we get a little bit further at the mountain, and then at some point, we get to look back, and we get to go, oh, wow, look how far I came. And then we take another few steps, and before you know it, you're looking back going, holy crap, look how far I just came, right? And you don't know how quickly that happens. So it seems like an early sobriety is really, really hard. It takes a really, really long time, and sometimes you don't know if you can do it. But if you stick with it and do it one day at a time, one step at a time, and know that you're not alone on that journey, that everybody's right here with you, supporting you, and here for you. And if you struggle with a higher power, this reverend right here is going to tell you that it does not freaking matter. It doesn't matter whatever your higher power is. My favorite definition of God in the rooms is a group of drunks. Because we can't get sober without the fellowship of each other. Good orderly direction is another one. It's great. It's great. It doesn't matter. And if you still struggle with that, come see me. I'll talk to you. We can talk it through. Whatever it takes is what we do in order to get sober. These days, I can look at myself, and I don't recognize myself anymore. But it's in a good way. It's in a way that I never imagined possible. We always say, don't leave before the miracle happens. But guess what? The miracles happen through you. They happen through you before you even know it. Look around at the people next to you. There are so many miracles sitting right here. Thank you guys for being here. Thank you for choosing to show up for yourself, because there's somebody in here that needs your light. There's somebody in your life that needs your light. And even if you don't feel like you've got it right now, it's there. It's there. So thank you for showing up tonight. Thank you for showing up for you. Thank you for showing up for me. Thank you for letting me talk to you tonight. Yeah, just know that I love you.
Thank you, Reverend Becca. Your story was amazing, and I love it so much, just as much as I love you.
First I slipped, and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. You rescued me, and finally, waking there I look into love's window for a soul that's been for me. Takes me where the promise is. sometimes quickly, sometimes slow. We get just what we need on a broad highway. God walks by, we walk eternally. Take me where the promise is.